Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Over a century ago, Chief Standing Bear and his Ponca Indian Nation tribe were forced to march an 800-mile trail of tears from their homeland in Nebraska to a reservation in Oklahoma. When he tried to return to Nebraska to bury his son, he was arrested. In 1879, he stood trial in one of the most important cases involving Native Americans in the nation's history. The trial of Standing Bear will soon become the subject of a new opera created by Opera Omaha. You're listening to musical excerpts from the opera, The Trial of Standing Bear.
The hands of the Ponca, head of bloodstained. What was their crime? They wished to bury a dead boy.
Because we learn so much history outside the classroom and from sources other than history textbooks, we at Talking History have produced several shows in which we've discussed the use or abuse of history in media such as the television, film, and historical fiction. This week, we'll examine the use of history in opera. In particular, we'll be talking to two of the key people involved in the creation and production of a new opera, Opera Omaha's The Trial of Standing Bear, that will premiere in the spring of the year 2002. Next, we'll be talking to composer Brent Michael Davids, who has written the music for the opera. We have with us Jane Hill, Opera Omaha's executive director, who wrote the libretto. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
Jane, start by giving us a brief synopsis of The Trial of Standing Bear, the actual historical event.
Well, the trial was preceded by the removal of the Ponca tribe from their traditional ancestral grounds along the Niobrara River to Indian territory, which is now Oklahoma. And this happened in 1877. It was a very difficult transition for the Ponca, and in a tribe which was a little over 600 people, about 158 of them died in the course of that, the trip and the year that followed it. One of them was Standing Bear's young son, Bear Shield. And on his deathbed, Standing Bear promised Bear Shield that he would take his body back to the ancestral burial grounds along the Niobrara and bury him there. And to carry out this promise, he set out with a small number of followers in January of 1879. Walked 500 miles in the dead of winter, made it as far as the Omaha Agency, and the Omaha, seeing that this group of Ponca were sick and exhausted and starving, invited them to stay and put in a winter wheat crop and then go further north when the weather had thawed. While they were there, plowing their fields, they were arrested by a detachment sent by General George Crook and ordered to be taken to Fort Omaha, detained, and then returned to Oklahoma. The issue being the fact that they had left this new reservation without the government's permission. And this is actually what initiated the tribe. And there's a good bit of support for the idea that George Crook himself actually came up with the idea that Standing Bear should sue him for wrongful imprisonment, because Crook was very sympathetic to their plight.
One particular about this otherwise wonderful story attracted you to do an opera about it?
Well, you know, in a way, it's a kind of a contemporary crisis of issues that attracted me to it. Crook, the newspaper editor Thomas Tibbles, who helped to bring this to the public's attention, Standing Bear himself, who essentially had to remove himself from his tribe and declare that he was no longer a chief in order to be declared a free man with the rights of a free man, and Suzette LaFleche, Bright Eyes, who was the daughter of the Omaha chief, who came to help with some of the translating. All four of these people had to step out of their comfort zone, it takes some risks in terms of their own careers and public opinion about them, and step forward to take part in something because they thought it was right. And I just think, particularly, you know, as you know, we're doing a lot of preparatory work with young people, this is a message that needs to be heard, that sometimes you just can't stay where you're comfortable or where your peer group tells you you should be. You have to do something because your conscience drives you to it.
Right. And being an historical event, what problems did it pose for you to translate it into an opera?
Well, first of all, it's a hugely ranging story in terms of, the trial itself, the events that led up to the trial, and always when you're dealing with the problem of translating something to the stage, it's what section of this story do I actually tell? What do I try to show? How am I going to develop it in a way that is accurate, but also dramatic? Because if you're simply, telling the events of the trial, and it doesn't involve the imagination of your audience, and it doesn't affect people emotionally, you haven't done your job. So it's trying to tell the historical events through the character relationships of the people involved.
And how faithful, ultimately, were you able to be to the history?
Well, I'm in the first draft stage, so I'm now kind of floating this libretto around to a number of other authorities, including Ponca and Omaha tribal people and some people who were involved in the history field here, and asking for some feedback. Everything that is in it, I can either substantiate through my research, or there are some areas that are a little mysterious where I've taken some dramatic license and hope somebody's not going to be able to come back and refute what I've said. For example, in the way I've used Mary Crook, General Crook's wife.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, in Crook's autobiography, which unfortunately doesn't extend to the period of this trial, he mentions his wife only once. And I found my dramatic imagination wandering in that direction and wondering if, well, perhaps it was because they didn't necessarily see eye to eye about his military career or what his feelings and opinions were about Indians. And so I have sort of used her as a spokesperson for what were very common opinions of the day, that she finds, that she thinks it's a good thing if Indians are put onto reservations, because both for their protection and for the protection of other people in society, and that they are wards of the nation and not free to wander at will. I don't know if those were actually her opinions, but I have used her as a spokesperson for those opinions.
I think that's effective because you do have these ideas being voiced by some of the common people in the taverns,
right,
or whatever, but she's really the only one among the major characters that serves that purpose.
Right, and I also wanted to use her as an example of a person in the society who was secure, living in a wonderful new house, having a certain level of material comfort that was completely alien to the life of these Indians. And so I could use it for dramatic contrast, too.
Now, there are a number of wonderful characters in here. Maybe I could just name a couple of them. You can tell me a little bit about them, or at least what you made of them in the opera, like Standing Bear himself.
Right. Well, Standing Bear, to my mind, is the Native American version of Martin Luther King. I think he was a man of tremendous eloquence, tremendous principle, and he spoke very simply from the heart, and this is clear in everything that he says, in all of his testimony, not only in the trial, but in the congressional hearing, which took place 2 years later. So I thought he was a tremendous sort of role model, again, for all of us who are interested in human rights.
I think his line, "I want to work and to be a citizen," is going,
right,
to be something that's going to cause pause in the audience, because this is such a controversial position for Native Americans.
Right. And I think that, the other character that I love is the character whose name Teja Butte translates as Buffalo Chip. And he was also very eloquent in talking about not wanting government handouts. Give us a way to survive on our own. Give us tools. Give us land. Give us seed. We don't want to be dependent. And it's quite heart-wrenching when they speak of these things.
Right. Tell us a little bit about General Crook. He's an interesting figure also.
I came to be a great admirer of General Crook, mainly from reading his autobiography. Despite a 30-year career in the military, he was quite an independent thinker, and in many ways a humanist. He did his job, but clearly it was a crisis of conscience that made him stand forward on the side of the Ponca to what might have been detrimental to his own career and his own future. So I have a lot of admiration for him. I also loved the fact that when I read about him, although he'd gone to West Point, he graduated 47th in his class of 58. He wasn't a scholar. He wasn't an intellectual. He was a wonderful field officer and admired both by his allies and his enemies.
He comes across with that standard dilemma, I suppose, of many people, but especially in the military, between carrying out orders and which run contrary to his own personal feelings.
Absolutely. And he talked about the possibility of resigning his commission over this order to capture the Ponca, and felt that if he did that, someone else would simply take his place and carry out the order.
What about Judge Dundee?
Well, Judge Dundee is an interesting character, too, because he was sort of seen as a liberal, and they were hoping, when this was moving toward trial, that Judge Dundee would take the case. It was hoped that if the Ponca might have someone sympathetic to their cause, that Judge Dundee would be that person. And indeed, as the trial worked out, he did make a monumental decision on their behalf.
Yeah. And again, a man torn. So many of your characters are torn between the law or their obligations.
That's right.
And
their own personal feelings. That's opera, Byron.
Well, I suppose. That makes a great opera.
Yeah.
Thomas Tibbles?
Thomas Tibbles had a fascinating background. He was, at the age of 10, sent away to be an indentured servant to a farmer because his own father had died, ran away from there, and lived on his own all through his youth and his teenage years. He, early on, I think because of these childhood injustices, became an idealist on the side of human rights and independence and freedom. And so it isn't surprising that he, in 1879, got involved in this whole crusade. He'd been with the paper at that point about 5 years. Many of the Omaha Daily Herald editorials that were written on behalf of Native peoples were written by him. But there again, he had a solid job and a house and a wife and two little children, and so he also took some risks in becoming the champion of the Ponca.
He seems to resist any pressure to become the idealist, to get inside as a reformer here.
Yeah, well, he's an older man at this
right.
point. You know, he's no longer the 16-year-old or 18-year-old, mm-hmm. but that clearly informs who he is and what he does.
Maybe that'll appeal to the 60s children in the audience who are now have respectable middle-class jobs.
I think it does. I think there's a message in there for all of us of not getting too comfortable.
Any other characters other than the ones that I cited that you found particularly interesting?
Well, I've mentioned Buffalo Chip, who I think is really very close to Standing Bear in his eloquence. I think that I love being able to introduce the characters of Anna Wilson and her companion Dan Allen, because I had stumbled across them in the Prospect Hill Cemetery. I found their graves and sort of conjectured, reading about them, that they would have been in the area in the time of the trial, ran a saloon, and so their saloon kind of becomes the opening scene in the opera, and that had a nice serendipitous feeling for me. I thought they were interesting characters.
Right. Now, I found it interesting that you used a dream version of the trial.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Well, you might be able to chalk it up to cheap theatrics. But one problem when you're doing a piece that is epic in this way is there are many themes and issues that I was afraid would get lost if they just came out in trial testimony. And I did want to posit this in a way as being Tibble's midlife crisis, that he dreams about the things from his past, including the year that he lived with the Indians when he was 16, that he's concerned about these social issues. And so by starting with a dream sequence where I could introduce both real and imaginary characters representing some of the issues in the opera, it gave me some dramatic freedom. And it also was a way for me to say, look, this is an opera. It's theatrical. Although it tries to be true to history, it's not a documentary. And by choosing some, frankly, very theatrical devices, like positing a 12-foot puppet that represents the government bureaucracy, right away you can establish with the audience that this is based on reality, but it is, a lot of it isn't real.
Yeah, the puppets are wonderful. Device. I can't
yeah.
wait to see that. Let me step back and take you a bit through the process
mm-hmm.
here. You did some research.
Yes.
You can tell us what sources you used and from which you created the libretto. Tell us about that part of the process.
Well, my major source was Tibble's book, which is called The Ponca Chiefs, The Standing Bear and the Ponca Chiefs. And this is his version of the trial, which was also substantiated when I went back and began reading the Omaha Daily Herald newspaper for that period of the trial. A lot of what is in the book was also in the newspaper, and he covered the trial as a reporter. So I think it's fairly reliable, although it certainly has his slant on things. I did a lot of reading from regional newspapers. It's great to have the Nebraska Historical Society and have those archives, to have access to that. I tried to read a lot about the Ponca tribe, their customs and their traditions, because I also want to represent the Ponca in a way that would not be terribly overly stereotypical and that would sort of honor their tradition. One of the interesting things I've been trying to do is to get Standing Bear's speech translated back into Ponca from English, because I think this this people who lost their language for all intents and purposes and are now trying to recover it, that that's an important historical aspect of the play.
Okay. Now, from that, you created a libretto, but mm-hmm. now this is not going to stand alone. It's being reviewed.
Right. I actually began with a scenario of what I thought the key scenes had to be. And then from that developed this draft libretto, which so that the composer could have something, you know, to work with musically and thematically. The other thing is, interestingly enough, is you don't just sort of do these things out in the wild world of imagination. I had to think practically, what roles could be double cast? How big do I want the chorus to be? How many principal singers will we be able to afford to hire? And so those, you start with some limitations in the way that you see the piece. For example, right now, Webster, the attorney, Standing Bear's attorney, is in the piece, but Poppleton, the other attorney, is not a singing role in the piece, and that may change as we go forward.
So your work is reviewed by Native Americans, by historians, people who know the history.
Right.
At the same time that you have people involved that will talk about how do you create a product from this history that's
right.
appealing and form of opera.
Exactly.
That is a challenge.
It is a very big challenge, but it's also great fun.
Sure. And then the next step is to send it off to the composer, and he creates appropriate
He has
music.
It. The stages we'll go through now is we will do this workshop that's kind of a sampler of the elements. There'll be the puppet that we've discussed. There'll be a couple of scenes. There'll be a little section that's being written as a small choral piece by the students at Benson High School called Letters to the Editor. And this scene between Crook and Tibbles, done with professional singers. Standing Bear's aria set to music. So we can show our audience a little bit of where we think we're going with this. Then there will also be discussion with the audience. What did you like? What are you? Are the things you're not comfortable with? Then we go into a rewriting stage, and Brent Michael Davis, the composer, with creating the rest of the music for the piece. We would hope to have that all completed for another full-length musical workshop of it in the spring of 2001. And then the actual production wouldn't be scheduled until fall of 2002.
Right. And we'll be talking to Brent
Great.
About the music. Thank you, Jane. You've been listening to Jane Hill, Executive Director of Opera Omaha and the author of the libretto for a new opera, The Trial of Standing Bear, to premiere in the spring of the year 2002.